right, turn to 2 Chronicles chapter 18 and put a marker there or your finger there, and then also get 1 Kings chapter 22. The reason we have to get both of these chapters tell the same story, and in a lot of places they're almost word for word identical, but in certain places each one of these accounts have details that the other one doesn't have, and so we need to look at both of them here this morning. This is the story of how Ahab and Jehoshaphat go into battle against Ben-Hadad of Syria, and what would turn out to be Ahab's last battle. And we set the stage for this a little bit already over the last couple of weeks. Jehoshaphat was a good king. He was a very godly king. He made a practice, we saw in the beginning of his reign, and this was maybe the most prominent thing about his early reign, but he made a practice of sending men out throughout the kingdom, out throughout his nation, to teach the word of God. And like we said before, that's one of those things where you look back and wonder, well, why didn't some of these other kings think of that? That was a pretty good idea, you know, because if the prosperity of Israel in that day was conditional on their obedience to the covenant, and it was, that was the covenant God had given them at Mount Sinai, and then before they come into the promised land in the latter chapters of Deuteronomy, it's clear that their success or failure in the land depends on their obedience to the covenant. You'd think that it would have occurred to somebody, it's a pretty good idea to have somebody go out and teach people what the law is, right? And Jehoshaphat did that, and God prospered him tremendously. He became very wealthy there in chapter 18, verse 1, 2 Chronicles. It says, now Jehoshaphat had riches and honor in abundance. And he had also a great army. He has an army of about 1.16 million men at his disposal. And so this is about as high a point as the southern kingdom has reached since the split between the northern and the southern kingdoms. And so he's doing very well. But he makes this mistake in chapter 18, his counterpart in the north, and let me back up and explain this again in case anybody forgets. This is, in this series of lessons, we're talking about the divided kingdom. The northern kingdom, the northern 10 tribes are split from the southern two, and the northern 10 tribes we call Israel usually, and the southern two tribes we know them by Judah. Well, in the north, there's this king named Ahab. Jehoshaphat's king in the south in Judah. His capital is Jerusalem. And there's this king in the north named Ahab, who's a very wicked king. He's apparently helped to reintroduce Baal worship in the north. And he wants to go fight against the Syrians. Now, he's already gone two rounds with the Syrians. Ben-Hadad had come and attacked him earlier. Ben-Hadad's the king of Syria. He had attacked Ahab earlier and laid siege to Samaria, which was Ahab's capital city. And God had given Ahab a miraculous victory, and he'd driven off the Syrians. And the Syrians decided that the reason why Ahab was able to defeat them, even though the Syrians had a much superior army, was because the God of Israel was a God of the hills. And as long as they fought him up in the hills, Israel would win. But he said, if we fight him in the plains, then our gods will prevail. So the next time they fight, they go down and fight in the plains. Well, God gives Israel the victory again. And this time he gives Ahab the opportunity to bring Ben-Hadad into judgment. He puts Ben-Hadad into Ahab's hands, and Ahab was supposed to kill Ben-Hadad for his rebellion against God, but Ahab let him go. And because of that, God told Ahab through the prophet that he was going to kill Ahab, that his life would be for Ben-Hadad's life, I think is the way he said it. And so Ahab now has a death sentence on him from God. Then beyond that, we saw in the incident with Naboth's vineyard, now Ahab not only has a death sentence, he has a death sentence of a shameful death where the dogs will lick his blood. But this is the situation now. Ahab wants to go fight Syria again. And maybe he thought that maybe he was emboldened because he'd won the first two times, but if he'd been paying attention to the prophecy, he probably would have got as far away from Ben-Hadad as he could. Well, at this time, the first two times they fought, Ben-Hadad came and attacked Ahab. But this third time, Ahab is going to go attack Ben-Hadad. I think maybe after the first two rounds, maybe Ben-Hadad had enough. Right? He wasn't coming back down there to mess with Israel anymore. But now Ahab's going to go attack him and try to retake the city of Ramoth-Gilead, which the Syrians had captured, which had been one of the cities of refuge. So it's an important city. But he asked Jehoshaphat to come with him to fight in the war. Now, remember, Israel and Judah have, for the most part, since they split, been rivals. Sometimes they even had skirmishes. Sometimes they even had outright war on occasion. But now they're going to make an alliance. Now, it's easy to see the benefit of this from Ahab's side, because Jehoshaphat has 1.16 million men in his army, right? So it's not hard to figure out why he'd want Jehoshaphat to come with him. Why Jehoshaphat goes with him? Well, probably part of national feeling, you know, wanting to reunite with his brethren. He had a particular grudge against the Syrians, probably, and he had a particular grudge against the people who had been king before Ahab's people took over in the north. Whatever he does there in verse 3, he makes a commitment. I am as thou art, and my people as thy people, and we will be with thee in the war. And this is the great mistake he makes. He makes his commitment before he inquires of God. And it's in the next verse, he says, inquire, I pray thee, at the word of the Lord today. And I think that's such a valuable, practical lesson. You do your inquiring first and your promising second, right? Yeah. That's a good way to handle life, isn't it? And don't make your promise or your oath or your vow of what you're going to do and then go ask God if that's what should be done, because you find yourself in a lot of trouble. And this is what happens. The lesson we looked at last week, there's a man named Micaiah who is a true prophet of God, and he tells Ahab what's going to happen if he goes down there to attack Assyria. He's not coming back. That's what Micaiah tells Ahab. And that's the prophecy. And we finish that up in verse 27. Micaiah said, if thou certainly return in peace, then hath not the Lord spoken by me. And he said, hearken all ye people. Ahab threw him in prison, said he was going to keep him in prison till he returned. Well, Ahab never returned. And that's an interesting thing to wonder about, isn't it? I wonder if Micaiah just died in that prison because he was sentenced to be there till Ahab returned, but Ahab never came back. Now, verse 28 is a very telling verse, I guess, about, I don't know, human nature. Micaiah has just told Ahab that if he goes up there, he's not going to return. But it says, so the king of Israel and Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, went up to Ramoth-Gilead. Well, I think if a man of God had told me I was going to die if I went up there, I'd have just stayed home, don't you? But they go anyway.
How many false prophets told him to look for gold?
400. Yeah. There were 400 false prophets there.
The numbers are right.
Yeah. So that's probably the thinking of Israel. Ahab wants that piece of ground. He's got his mind set on it. We already know how Ahab gets when he got his mind set on a piece of ground. We saw that with Naboth's vineyard, right? That when he couldn't get it, he went home and started crying, and you know, and he's kind of spoiled. He wants to get what he wants. And so he goes, and here's the trouble. Now Jehoshaphat is committed to go with him because he made his promise that he would send all of his army down there to help Ahab before he asked God. Now, don't you think Jehoshaphat right about then wished that he'd asked God first? This is not the first time things like this happen in the scriptures. There's a story in the book of Joshua about when the people first came into the land. God had told them to kill all the people of that land, just wipe it clean. And there was a group of people called the Gibeonites who had heard this was what was going on. And they were pretty clever. They knew they couldn't beat Israel because God was helping Israel. And so they decided to all dress up in old clothes and carry around moldy bread and things like that and tell them, we're in a long journey. We're not from here. This is not where we live. We came from way off somewhere. because Israel was not commanded to kill visitors from a strange country, right? They're only commanded to kill the residents. So they pretended like we're not really from here. And Israel made a covenant with them before they asked God whether that was right. Now, if they'd asked God, God would have told them, don't do this, right? But they made a covenant. And once you make a covenant or an oath or a promise, you're held to that, right? We had the same thing, remember, in the book of Judges, old Jephthah, who made a vow or an oath that if God gave him a victory, he'd kill whatever was the first thing that came out of the gate to grill. It was his own daughter that came out. And that's why I always tell people, you know, be careful about making oaths or vows. Let me turn here to Matthew chapter 5. And I won't get on this too much because I think Kurt will get there eventually, one of these days, Lord willing. If I miss enough Sundays of teaching Sunday school, he'll get down there in the Sermon on the Mount. But yeah, somewhere in there. Yeah. Matthew chapter 5. Verse 33, it says, "Again, ye have heard that it hath been said by them of old time, thou shalt not forswear thyself, but shalt perform unto the Lord thine oaths. But I say unto you, swear not at all, neither by heaven, for it is God's throne, nor by the earth, for it is his footstool, neither by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. Neither shalt thou swear by thy head, because thou canst not make one hair white or black. But let your communication be yea, yea, nay, nay, for whatsoever is more than these cometh of evil." And I won't turn there now, but James has something very similar in chapter 5, verse 12, I think it is, of his book. And the idea there is it's an unwise thing to swear to do things or make oaths to do things. For one thing, if you make an oath or a vow or a promise to do something, sometimes there are circumstances outside your control that could cause you to break your promise, right?
Isn't there a verse in the Old Testament that says, better not to make a vow after you make it?
Yeah. And so that's what happens. You know, we're not like God. We're not sovereign, right?
Yeah.
So if I make an oath to do something, there may be circumstances come in my life outside my control that keep me from breaking that oath. And then I've got a broken oath on my head, right? And I tell people sometimes, now, I hope you understand what I mean when I say things like this. Sometimes I've been in church services where you get to an invitation and you have a preacher get up there and he'll invite people or ask people or encourage them to come up and make a vow to God to do this or that or the other. And I always tell people, be careful about that, about making vows to God, about what you're going to do. Because then if you fail, not only have you failed God, but you've got a broken vow on your head on top of that. And by the way, you don't have the power in yourself to carry out any vow you make to God anyway. It'd be much wiser, instead of saying, God, I promise you I will, to say, God, will you help me please to do this? There's the potential for any of us in the heat of a moment, in an emotional time, to say something that we regret later on, right? And that's what I say, people. Don't let somebody push you into making a vow to God, especially if you haven't inquired of God first to make sure that's what you're supposed to be doing. And I think that's the right attitude when we come to God. First of all, say, Lord, what would you have me to do? And then instead of puffing yourself up and saying, Lord, I'm going to do it, say, Lord, if you don't help me, I can't do it. So would you please help me? And God honors that kind of a heart, doesn't he? The humble heart that will come to him in that manner. Now, it gets worse in verse 29. Jehoshaphat's already promised to go. He's committed himself. Remember in verse 3, he says, I am as thou art, and my people as thy people, and we will be with thee in the war. Now, that I am as thou art is about to come back and haunt him real big in this next verse, because it says, the king of Israel said unto Jehoshaphat, I will disguise myself and will go to the battle, but put thou on thy robes. So the king of Israel disguised himself and they went to the battle. Now, I don't know if you know anything about battle, how battle works, but generally speaking, if the king's on the battlefield, he's the guy you want to try to kill, right? And everybody wants to know who the king is so they can target him. We'll see that here in a minute. And even in modern times, it's a common practice that field officers don't display their insignia real prominently in the battlefield, because you know the other side is looking for the officer, right? Because they figure if they can kill the officer, that puts the rest of the troops in disarray. So here's what Ahab says. says, I'm going to disguise myself. I'm not going to go down there looking like a king, but you put your robes on and just strut in there like the king. And I expect that Jehoshaphat's really regretting that I am as thou art right now, don't you? Because he has to present himself as the king. Now, it may have been that Ahaz pretending like you go ahead and act like the king and you get the glory. But what Ahab knows is I may save my head this way. He thought he could work his way around. That's a trouble with a lot of people in the world even today, isn't it? They think they can find a workaround to the way God has said things work. So that's his plan. He's going to disguise himself. They go to the battle. And verse 30 says, now the king of Syria had commanded the captains of the chariots that were with him, saying, fight ye not with small or great, save only with the king of Israel. Now, let me say a word about these captains. And here's where we need to come back to 1 Kings 22. Verse 31, it tells the same thing, but it says this, but the king of Syria commanded his 32 captains that had rule over his chariots, saying, fight neither with small nor great, save only with the king of Israel. And it gives that specific number of 32. Now, if you remember back a good ways, that number of 32 captains has some significance, because when Ben-Hadad first came down to attack Ahab the first time, in 1 Kings chapter 20, verse 1, it said, and Ben-Hadad, the king of Syria, gathered all his host together, and there were 32 kings with him. He had a lot of sub-kings. He was kind of a ruler over a lot of little small kingdoms. So he had these 32 kings that came up to battle with him to fight. Now, after he got whipped that first time down there, and God had given Israel the victory, down in verse 23 of that same chapter, he says, and the servants of the king of Syria said unto him, we mentioned this earlier, their gods are gods of the hills, therefore they were stronger than we. But let us fight against them in the plain, and surely we shall be stronger than they. And they thought that was some pretty good advice, but they want a little more insurance. They said, and do this thing, take the kings away, every man out of his place, and put captains in their rooms. He says it's time to get the political figureheads off the battlefield and get some military men in there, because we feel like we'll have a better chance to win. Now, these 32 captains had come back to fight that second battle, and they got beat again. But now he's still got these 32 captains, and they're coming into this fight. And now Ben-Hadad has narrowed his focus. See, Ben-Hadad actually didn't ask for this war, did he? This Ahab comes to him. And I don't know that he really wants to fight Israel. But he's got one goal in mind this time, and that is vengeance on Ahab, right? And he's lost his focus on everybody else. So he says, you just look for the king. These 32 captains, these would be, remember, David had his mighty men. I guess this would be Ben-Hadad's mighty men, so to speak. And he tells his mighty men, his top officers, don't worry about anybody else on the field. You go get the king of Israel. Now, because the king of Israel, Ahab, is disguised and the king of Judah is dressed up in his robes, in the next verse we have a case of mistaken identity. And they come after Jehoshaphat. It says, and it came to pass when the captains of the chariots saw Jehoshaphat that they said, it is the king of Israel. Of course, it wasn't, but he was the only fellow on the field that looked like a king, right? And so and it's possible that Ben-Hadad didn't even know Judah was there, right? He knows Israel's coming to attack him, and he probably assumes that it's Ahab. So therefore, they compassed about him to fight. And this thing that happens next is very wonderful. He's encircled. He has no protection. Even though Jehoshaphat has this huge army, 1.16 million men. Now, because of this, and let's be honest, he's kind of put himself in this situation a little bit, hasn't he? He's the one that made the vow. He's the one that goes down there. He's the one that goes into battle wearing the robes while the other king is disguised. And now they've surrounded him. So instead of having 1.16 million men against whatever army Syria has, now he's outnumbered 32-1. He's in the middle of the circle, and it looks hopeless, doesn't it? You know, you can get yourself in such a bad situation that maybe even sometimes when God's people around you are prospering, even when the church around you is prospering, it feels like you're all alone and you're surrounded and helpless and hopeless. And you know what you do in a place like that? You do what Jehoshaphat did. It says this, but Jehoshaphat cried out, and the Lord helped him. Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah.
Now, yeah, there's a message right there. That, think about this. This is a man who had just made a pretty big error. And we're going to find out as we go further along. I don't know if we'll get there this morning or not. We're going to find out that the choice that Jehoshaphat made in allying himself with Ahab, God's not going to let him go scot-free for that. There is going to be a penalty to pay. But on this day, when this godly king who, listen, God didn't put him in this mess, right? He got himself in this mess. You can't blame God for any of this. This is Jehoshaphat's fault. I'm not putting him down. He's a great godly man, probably a lot more godly man than I am. But on this day, he's gotten himself into a mess because he disobeyed God. But you see the grace and the mercy of God that at this moment, when this man cries out to God, the Lord helped him. Isn't that amazing? Well, thank God for his mercy and his grace, right?
Yeah.
Because that's the situation of all of us. Even when we came to Christ to be saved, we couldn't blame any of our sin on him, could we? We got ourselves in this mess. Because we disobeyed him. And he was under no obligation to help us at all. But thank God he came to our aid and saved us. Well, notice what God did. And this is amazing too. It says, and God moved them to depart from him. You know, this may not seem like as dramatic a thing as knocking down the walls of Jericho or parting the Red Sea or sometimes sending hail and thunder and lightning on people. But in a way, it's just as amazing, isn't it? These are trained military men, 32 captains, maybe Ahab or been had as best men. And they have one job, to attack the king of Israel. And there's only one man on the field that looks like a king, and they've got him surrounded. And then they just leave. Can you imagine that? We don't have the details of exactly how this happened. Does this mean that God moved their minds so that they just all decided, well, this is not important? Or did God just physically move them? I mean, that's possible too, right?
Yeah.
That God just picked them up and moved them somewhere else. But whatever happened, they left Jehoshaphat and departed. It kind of reminds you of the time when they were about to kill Jesus and he just passed through the crowd, right? He just walks right through them. And nobody quite understands how or why it happened, but it's amazing, isn't it, that God can do this. He's got power over everything, and we'll see that further as we come into this next part. It says, for it came to pass that when the captains of the chariots perceived that it was not the king of Israel. Now, how did they know that? How did they know that this was not Ahab? You understand that most of them probably had never seen Ahab face to face. But it has to be something that God just put in their hearts, right? And now they turn back again from pursuing him. And notice what happens next. You know, it doesn't matter how much you plan or connive to try to get out of the will of God. God's got a better plan than you do. And not only does he have a plan, he has control. Notice what happens here in verse 32. It says, for it came to pass that when the captains of the chariots perceived that it was not the king of Israel, they turned back again from pursuing him. And a certain man drew a bow at a venture and smote the king of Israel, that's Ahab, right, between the joints of the harness. Therefore he said to his chariot man, turn thine hand that thou mayest carry me out of the host, for I am wounded. Here's what happens to Ahab. He's got himself disguised. He's got his plan, right? He thinks, they can't find me here. Well, there are a lot of people in this world that kind of think, well, God can't find me here, right? People try to sneak off away from God. Well, Jonah tried it one time, didn't he? He said, if I get on this boat, God can't find me out there. But God knew where Ahab was all the time. And it says a certain man, there's a good message in that too. One of these days I'm going to preach on a certain man. Because there's a lot of these anonymous characters throughout the Bible, right? It's just a certain man or certain one or somebody like that. We never even told their name. They just, God uses them for one moment, one time to do something. And there's just a unknown fellow in the Syrian army who, it says, draws a bow at a venture. That is, he's not particularly aiming at anything. Now, that may sound odd, but it was not uncommon in ancient battle that sometimes instead of aiming at a particular target, you just have a line of archers line up and just sort of make a wall of arrows to fire toward the enemy, hoping, because, you know, that in those days, some of the bows weren't all that accurate anyway, right? So you use it almost like artillery. You just launch it downfield and hope it hits something. So he's not aiming at anything in particular, but God is, right? See, this man wasn't aiming the arrow. God had control of this arrow, didn't he? God was in charge. And it says he hit him between the joint of the harness. That would be a point in his armor. You know, almost any kind of armor that a man could put on, there's a weak spot in it somewhere, isn't there? And this is where because, you know, you can't just put yourself in a solid cast of iron, right? So there has to be joints in it somewhere. And that's going to be a weak spot. And this is where that arrow hits. And you see the sovereignty of God in that, don't you? You see how God has control of everything in this world. Now, this works negatively, but it also works positively too, doesn't it? For the man who disobeys God, there's no place to hide. God can use a man who seems like he's just behaving at random, but the truth is, there's nothing really all that random in this world, is there? See, some people have this idea of God, even some people who believe in God have this idea of him being far off. They have this idea that God made the world and he just sort of wound it up and let it go however it would, and that we can change the course of things and maybe defy God's plan. But you can't do that. God is actively working in the affairs of this world all the time, isn't he? So much so that, now think about this, knowing that one day there would be a king named Ahab who he had to deal with, God had been preparing a certain man. I wonder how long God had been preparing that man to be in the army of Syria on this day. How many things would you have to go through? How many generations, through how many hundreds or thousands of years to make sure that all the circumstances work out just right so that this particular man is on this particular battlefield on this particular day? And God was working all this out, I think, before Ahab was even born, don't you? And he had the thing prepared. He's got all things in his hand, doesn't he?
Yes.
And he has this man there with his bow and his arrow. And you think about this, that I don't know, again, sometimes you don't know how God does things. I don't know if he just had this man, think about what this would require in history to not only bring this man to this battlefield, but on the one hand, maybe what he did was he got this man prepared with just the right bow. And think about it, back in those days, they didn't have mass production. There's probably a good deal of variety in every bow on the field. It's probably a little different, right? And every arrow is, you know, probably significantly different. They would shoot different. But God had prepared a certain bow and a certain arrow. And he puts this man in just the right spot. And he gets him to pull on the bow just the right amount. Because they didn't have compound bows right back then. You know, this is how hard you pull back would affect the flight of the arrow. And so he pulls back just enough and holds the bow at just the right trajectory, knowing that Ahab was going to be in this other spot. There's a lot of physics in this, you know. I mean, that God had to have planned out all the way back. Either that, or I wonder if maybe God just had a guided missile. Wouldn't you like to have been there? I mean, what if this guy actually just shot the other direction and God turned it around, you know, because he needed... I don't know how it happened. I know this, God's in control of it. That's the point, God was in control. Now, like I said, this works positively and negatively. If God is this much in control of this arrow to be able to render punishment on this man, do you know he's just as much in control of this world for those who will come to him and pray to him and seek his will and seek his favor? he can work things out just the same way.
Yeah.
Ways that are miraculous and unexpected and seem entirely random, but they're not. There's no such thing as luck in this world, really, is there?
No.
We talk about good luck and bad luck, but God's in control of the whole thing. And that's what happens here. So he's asked to be carried out of the host. Now, he doesn't leave the field exactly. He's sort of on the margin or the periphery, I guess, still trying to command. But he's not down in the heat of the battle now. And it says, and the battle increased that day, howbeit the king of Israel stayed himself up in his chariot against the Syrians until the even. Now, we've criticized Ahab a lot, but let's give him credit for one thing. He's pretty tough, isn't he? I mean, he's got an arrow at him, and he manages to stay up in his chariot the rest of the day trying to guide the battle. So we'll give him those roses anyway, if we can't give him anything else, right? He was pretty tough, and it says until the even, and about the time of the sun going down, he died. And that's how Ahab departs from the scene. Now, we turn back here to 1 Kings chapter 22 and get just a little bit more of the story in verse 37, because this is important, and we'll try to get this maybe and finish up here. It says, so the king died and was brought to Samaria. This is verse 37. So the king died and was brought to Samaria, and they buried the king in Samaria. And this is an important detail that we don't get in Chronicles. Yeah. It says, and one washed the chariot in the pool of Samaria, and the dogs licked up his blood, and they washed his armor according unto the word of the Lord, which he spake. So this is what happens to Ahab. Now, remember, the reason this came upon him is because in chapter 21, he had desired the vineyard that belonged to that man Naboth, and Jezebel plotted to have Naboth killed. And when Naboth had been killed, remember what they did. They actually brought Naboth into court, so to speak, and made false accusations against him and got him killed that way. So he died what would be considered a shameful death, and they let the dogs lick his blood. And, of course, the dog was an unclean animal, so that was a great shame to anybody in Israel to have a dog lick their blood when they died. And because he had done that, God had made a prophecy. This is 1 Kings chapter 21, verse 19. This is Elijah speaking. It says, thou shalt speak unto him, saying, thus saith the Lord, hast thou killed and also taken possession? And thou shalt speak unto him, saying, thus saith the Lord, in the place where dogs lick the blood of Naboth, shall dogs lick thy blood, even thine. So Ahab's not just going to die a shameful death, just an ordinary death. He's going to die a shameful death. And God is going to humiliate him in his death. Not only that, he's actually going to bring him to the exact spot. You talk about God superintending in affairs. What are the chances, if it were just left to luck, that this man who's washing out the chariot of Ahab would bring that chariot to the exact spot where Naboth's blood had been licked by the dog? But that's what happened. And if I understand this right, it must be that Naboth had been brought down to Samaria for judgment. He lived in Jezreel, remember, but that's just kind of a little village. So they must have taken him up to the capital for judgment. And he was killed there, and the dogs licked his blood, and God kept his promise. Because God's in charge, isn't he? Ahab's an interesting character because, remember, after that incident with Naboth, he actually dressed himself up in sackcloth and ashes and made a kind of repentance. But it was, I think, the kind of repentance where he's sorry he got caught. He never, I think, entirely got over his respect or fear for God completely. And I think he lived probably a very sad kind of life because of that, you know. It'd almost be rather better to just be an outright heathen than to be on the fence, wouldn't it? You understand what I mean? Because on the fence, you're tormented all the time. And there were times when he would kind of repent. And remember, after he saw God sent down the fire up on Mount Carmel there for a little while, he becomes obedient to Elijah. Elijah tells him to go up on the mountain, he goes up. Elijah tells him to go down, he goes down. Elijah tells him to head back for Jezreel, he goes, you know. And I think in the end what it was that as far as his will, he was just a very weak man. I think Jezebel kind of drug him around. And actually the scripture lays a lot of the blame for this on Jezebel Verse chapter 21, verse 5 says, "But there was none like unto Ahab, which did sell himself to work wickedness in the sight of the Lord, whom Jezebel, his wife, stirred up." And it makes you wonder if he might have been a better man if he'd had a better wife. But that's the choices men make, you know. And let me say this before I finish. I've got to say this and take off. Because we don't want to. We've talked a lot about in this lesson about how God is completely in charge of everything. He's sovereign. He's the master of all things. He can bring about whatever fate he wants to for men. And those things are wonderful truth. Sometimes people go too far with that, though, and take it to mean like that man has no personal responsibility. And there are certain movements, theological movements, that take it as so far as to talk about things like irresistible grace and things like that, which make it seem as if there's no responsibility on the part of man. No, that's not the case with Ahab, because God made it very clear in the case of Ahab that chapter 20, verse 42, when after he'd let Ben-Hadad go, he said unto him, "Thus saith the Lord, because thou hast let go out of thy hand a man whom I appointed to utter destruction, therefore thy life shall go for his life, and thy people for his people." See, there's a because there, because thou, right? God's in charge of all things, but God knew before he ever made the earth what Ben-Hadad was going to do and what Ahab was going to do. But still, it's because of what Ahab did, right? So we can't relieve him of his personal responsibility. Same thing in the incident with Naboth. He gets a because thou in there, right? So there is a personal responsibility in there. And Ahab, because of what he has done, because of his long-term rebellion against God, and God gave him many, many chances to repent. But in the end, the bill comes due, right? And no man can escape God. When God says that the time has run out, it's run out. And that's what God has done here with Ahab. And now he passes off the scene. Well, we'll have to stop there for this morning because we're out of time. Next time, Lord willing, we'll pick up in 2 Chronicles chapter 19 and see how God deals with Jehoshaphat. Jehoshaphat's still got, he still got to go out behind the woodshed for a minute because of his alliance that he made with Ahab. And there's going to be a battle he has to fight because of this. And not only that, there's going to be trouble comes in the kingdom for a long time because Jehoshaphat allowed intermarriages between his family and Ahab's family, and that's going to cause trouble for a while. So we'll see that as time goes on, Lord willing.